climb on up with us to the Jerusalem rooftop. Hello and welcome. Well, today I'm a bit, last night me and some of the production crew were at a wedding and it was a bit wild. So my voice is kind of a bit smoky and heavy today. And it's kind of hard to, it's a bit heavy.
It's good for radio.
Yeah, generally it is. Okay.
It's the best for radio.
It's the best. So let me introduce you. So today we have with us Yosef Leib Nidelman.
Yeah, Nidelman Ruiz, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And you may have asked yourself the connection between Judaism, Hasidus in general, and marijuana, and culture, and other things. Well, this guy literally wrote the book on it.
Hoo-ha.
In 2009, right?
Something like, I think eight.
2008?
Yeah.
Okay. 2008, released a book, Cannabis Hasidus. And he is active both in the legalization area for years, both here and abroad, and we'll discuss that, hopefully. And also, he's active in all kinds of interesting adventures, and hopefully we'll be able to cover some of those.
Amen.
Amen. But first, we have our plug. Have you ever been to the supermarket, gone down, and there was no rice? Ever happened to you?
There's usually some kind of rice, but it's not always on the level.
Doesn't happen to you? Okay. So let's say that there wasn't any rice. Well, we invented a genius thing. We call it Orez Ben-Gurion, Ben-Gurion rice, titim.
Ah, that's what I thought you meant.
Titim is great and delicious, and it's empty carbs, which is always great. It's round, like the circle of life.
Kids love it.
Tite Ben-Gurion, come on, eat it. All right, so Yosef.
Oh, that's our sponsor?
Yes, it is.
Oh,
yes.
Good.
Ben-Gurion's directly involved with it.
Right.
It's very complicated. Very complicated issue right there. So tell me, what is a cannabis chassid?
That's a great question. I feel like it is connected to this issue of Orez Ben-Gurion in a funny way. Because why is there such a thing as Orez Ben-Gurion? Is we could not get shlichut of something from the Mizrach. So we had to bring it from the Ma'arav and make a version that was like something from Mizrach. I feel like couscous is a similar kind of invention. Where
what do you mean?
Dochan, couscous is in the tzura of dochan, which was a very normal thing for the Olam HaMizrach. Going down to Africa, all the way to China, dochan is a great summertime hot weather alternative to chitin. But then every so often, the trade routes get cut off because of the nature of the international trade and what's able to move and what's not.
Yeah.
A, what's able to move, and B, what you're able to grow and make locally. What you're able to produce locally. That's a lot of how Orez Ben-Gurion, how Titim became such a staple, was because people are coming from the Arzot HaMizrach, and rice is such a huge staple. It's just such a major thing. And they needed to have something that was like it, but was not it, because we had access to things from the West, but not from the East, for that minute. And I think that's very connected to the problem of cannabis and Hasidut.
Okay.
Which have to do with reconstructing the thing that was alive in the holy using what you have nearby. It's one of the big chidushim in chassidut, one of the major functions of marijuana in modernity, where it used to be a lot of what would naturally trigger an ecstatic religious spiritual experience was part of everyone's culture, because culture grew out of a like ecstatic religious experience. And in the absence of so much of what made culture possible in antiquity, we need to be able to reconstruct that on localized levels. And that's one of the amazing things that both marijuana and chassidut have in common, that they are ways of taking something from the Olam HaKadmon and making it very accessible in a personalized modern context, which has its own issues and concerns built in.
Okay, that's like, an interesting yeah, aspect.
Yeah.
But you speak also, I mean, in the book, you reference all kinds of ancient things. Hasidus is relatively modern, I would say, in the past few hundred years.
They use that word recurringly, because they use the term in the Gemara to refer to the Hasidim Rishonim.
Yeah.
Right, it's the whole thing. Most of Chazal are not so into davening, they're into learning Torah. Right, Rabbi Gamliel sort of talks snap about the guy who's davening for too long, says he's like giving up his chelik in the next world for his chelik in this world, because davening is just about this world, Rabbi Gamliel seems to imply.
Yeah.
But then they describe a minhag of the Hasidim Rishonim to just spend hours, like 1 hour getting ready, just stretching, doing yoga, whatever. 1 hour like fully in the zone of davening, and 1 hour afterwards just coming down.
Right.
Just like trying to reaccommodate. And there's a lot of the tacit minhagim that I think Chassidut tries to take from the Eidot HaMizrach very early on, tries to adopt, including taking on the Nusach of Sfarad and taking on the Arizal and taking on the Zohar and taking on the Shulchan Aruch, even to the degree that they do, is very much about trying to go back to that. Because there's also a movement called the Hasidei Ashkenaz in the medieval period.
I'm not aware of that.
Rav Yehuda Hasid and Sefer Haredim and Sefer Hasidim are these two kind of Sfarim from before Kabbalah becomes friendly, when the major mystical movement is sort of pietism, fasting, and it seems like a pretty miserable period, because the whole medieval period is a lot of just death, a lot of like black death. You know, a lot of like...
not great fun.
No, if you survive, then they're very suspicious of you. If you don't die from the diseases, they're probably going to lock you in a shul and burn it to death. Because like, that's just part of what's going on. So a lot of the...
But in the Muslim countries, that it was the situation was a bit better, right?
Baruch Hashem.
Right?
Baruch Hashem. Although there is a lot going on.
Time, right?
Well, it takes a while before it settles down to the golden age. Like, it takes a while because there is a lot of just conflict and just invasion and contention back and forth. And part of the reason there's so much backlash in Europe, let's say Spain back and forth, is because there's also a lot of conflict on all the borders between whoever's coming and whoever's going. I almost said between like Crusaders and Muslims, but even internally, like a bunch of the Crusades and a bunch of the Muslim conflicts are all internal. Like I live in Emek Haila. I live in Moshav Aderet. And I was looking at the history of the area. The first war between Muslims is right over there, curiously enough. David kills Goliath, border conflict, little intense border conflict. But also, it's one of the major sites of the Crusades, but not even so long after that, Queen Aisha is troubled by how the Rashidun Caliphate is going. For some reason, she does not approve of what was a strong union of also Abu Bakr and also Ali, which is before the Sunni and Shia split. Yeah. There's still one army, and Aisha, who was Muhammad's youngest wife, approves of neither of them. She doesn't like something going on, sends a whole army from Iran to try to fight them, and they have a whole conflict right there until she's defeated and politely escorted home by Ali himself. And I think a lot of those conflicts keep going, because the nature of conflicts is like, if you're directed against an enemy, okay. And then once that enemy is defeated, like, well, you still have to direct yourself against somebody. There's still a lot of internal conflict.
Yeah.
One of the big issues in the world, one of the reasons all those, like, no kind of revolution seems to go on for so long without then having some kind of internal power thing. One of the big psychological questions, the reason you have, like, Lacan trying to integrate Marxism with psychology is because the war does seem to go on forever. And both Chassidut and marijuana offer to try to help with resolution about that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I think so. Because that's really what modernity and postmodernity is all about in a lot of ways. Finding a way out of having to have the war that still lets you be prepared for the war on many levels. And this is a delicate thing. Because let's say Enlightenment religions, like 2,000 years ago, also Christianity, also Buddhism, are very much about saying, like the Chiddush of saying, you know what, better not to fight. Better not to win, let it go. Even if you die, even if your family's killed, it's better. You shouldn't have to become that. And that's a certain big chiddush for the world. And it only really works for so long, because at a certain point, people can't really build a culture on just losing. You know, that's not what it's for. That's not what it's for. One of those big Western philosophers, I think Schopenhauer, he says, has a whole big kitrug against Western Christianity. He says, like, you know, if you're winning, you're not being a very authentic Christian. If you're like, if you have property, they've been saying that, St. Francis saying that for a long time. If you have any chalik in this world, then you know, who are you kidding? And one of the things that Chassidut does in general, in the book Cannabis Chassidus, I do try to define Chassidut as a phenomenon beyond just Yahadut, where it's a tendency within religions to mishaper themselves by finding the core truth and value and relating them into the modern situation. It's a recurring phenomenon.
A type of reform, basically?
I almost said like a type of renewal, ha 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 ha, but those are both very charged words in
the context of Judaism.
Yeah, those are both like edot, right? Yeah. And edot that are already kofar on what most people are doing, and thus hard to really think of as being authentic and legitimate. And like one of the challenges that Chassidut, on the other hand, is overwhelmingly legitimate, frustratingly legitimate. Every time, let's say, because it was a big problem in the 20th century, but not just the 20th century, also the Hasidei Ashkenaz, the reaction to the Hasidei Ashkenaz is the Rambam, right?
The rationality, kind of connection to these kind of abstract ideas of Kabbalah laying below the surface.
Right, or different abstract ideas. Abstract ideas that you can objectively maintain as truths instead of mythic ideas, which have more to do with like a narrative inspiring feeling.
And a symbol.
This is a lot the Mechilu. Because let's say a lot of early Kabbalah does look at the Rambam. Abulafia, one of Abulafia's first books, is a perush on the Rambam. He's totally into the Rambam. Because what the Rambam has in common with Kabbalah is fundamental principles. Right? Aristotle also likes chesed, gvura, and teferet. He's not using that lashon, but he is talking about a rule of like something and the antithesis and the harmony in between. That's Neoplatonism, which is part of why some historians try to say that Kabbalah is rooted in like Greek Neoplatonism, because you could say they do have fundamental true principles of harmony in common. And that's the thing that makes them different from modern sciences. In a lot of ways, they have reason in them, and they are anti-mythic to the degree that they are looking at fundamental priorities behind the mythology. But as soon as they get too dry and as soon as they get too abstract, they become maddening. It's one of the issues with all the rational movements, also 20th century, and also the Rambam, is part of why Yahadut went with the Shulchan Aruch as a main sefer for accepting a concept of halakha as something you could just read in a book instead of the Rambams, like Svarim, instead of the Mishnah Torah.
And do you think that both of these worlds, this kind of more rational and the other one that's more mythical, more symbolic, they both have room for such a material, for such type of a way to express themselves through ecstasy, through some kind of material object that changes your perception?
For sure. And a proof is Rambam's son, right? Avram ben Maimon, he gets into Sufism. He becomes a Sufi. He doesn't renounce anything from the Rambam. He embraces spinning around in circles and getting high as an expression of the concepts the Rambam says and justifies them in relatively similar terms, except he maintains that the Sufis have traditions from the Beis HaMikdash for how to achieve Nevuah that the rest of us gave up on.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That connect kind of to that idea of, they say that Abraham sent presents to the East, and that's kind of one of the rationalities that some people have, that they say that a lot of the Eastern ideas are based in some kind of old Judean idea.
Right. They must be.
They must be,
because how could it be? And this was definitely the beginning of the writing of Cannabis Chassidus also. I grew up with this assumption also. Anything that's deeply true and important, powerful, must be rooted.
Must be Jewish, right?
Or if not Jewish, pre-Jewish. Avraham Avinu, I was talking to my daughter about this Shabbos.
Yeah.
She was like, how Jewish is Avraham Avinu? There's already
an Indian. That's a great question.
It's a great question, because some people talk about him like he's Mamish the first Yid. And on the other hand, there is an Indian, even in Midrash, to differentiate between Avraham and Yisrael. There's a Midrash that I mentioned to her, where the Malachi Hasharis, they'd heard from the beginning of creation, there's a concept of something called Yisrael that will justify all creation. And when Adam Rishon comes along, they ask Hashem, is that him? And Hashem's like, no. And when Avraham Avinu comes along, he's like, surely this is him. And Hashem says, no, He loves that which I hate. Ahuv lo masha sanuali, I think is the Lashon in Midrash Rabbah, which is a very loaded political kind of statement, but it says something to do with the difference between Avraham Avinu's path and the expansiveness in it, and the thing that becomes called Yisrael, and the degree of limitedness inherent within it. Because a lot of the definitions of Yisrael have to do with Nivchar, and it's a very controversial. Well, let's even say that. Okay, chosen is a good word, but also let's say distinctified.
Distinctified.
Ben Yisrael la'amim.
Okay.
We don't say Ben Avraham la'amim.
So that question could be asked. I mean, could be pointed towards you and say, you know, we always have this book where, I mean, my parents have, you know, a whole bunch of books in their house, and there's like the top Jews in this,
right?
In that, the top Jews in baseball, right. In basketball,
right.
In
this organized and that. Crime, right?
You know, in organized crime, of course. You know, and there are certain places, obviously, that Jews were more prominent in. But then the question could be raised: why are you taking something like cannabis, or use of drugs, or any material thing, and connecting it to something that's? I mean, people are, even if there was some kind of tradition, or maybe there still is a tradition of it, people are not going and smoking in the middle of synagogue. It's never. Widely unaccepted. I mean, I don't know if you'd find the chief rabbi being supportive of it. Like, why try to make this connection?
So that's a great question. Nebuch, for as dry and frustrating as shuls are, I feel like the best shuls are the ones that are much more comfortable with, like, intoxication. I think that's the general rule. Kiddush is a pretty central part of the entire shul experience. On the moshav where I live, one of the major distinctions between the different batei knesset is when do they start drinking and where. It's an interesting phenomenon. I did not realize this.
Yes.
But this is like neighbors were telling me, like the there's the shul that's the most kind of batik and can like sort of like and they say it's almost like
starting
almost
early a pub. In the morning.
Yeah, almost like a pub. They talk about it because people don't like, they just have like flasks of arak with them during, before, like during Pesach Zimra, before everything. Intoxication on physical substance is pretty inherent to the entire Jewish concept of the holy. So much so that the first Jewish community in Rome was expelled under suspicion of being Dionysians back before Rome really had a secure relationship to Dionysianism.
Why don't you expand on that? What do you mean by that?
Okay, fine. There's different kinds of religion. And let's say it's long been argued that maybe you could get them down to just two kinds of religion. There's sobriety religion and there's intoxication religion. Sobriety religion is about, and these are also very personal things. It's very personal, but it's also national or cultural priorities. There's building religion around perfectionism, around masonry, building perfect structures, having perfect math, having like a well-figured out theology, having very defined rules that are just the best rules ever. And this is by the Greeks and Romans identified with the sun and like the L that takes over the sun, Apollo, right? And on the other hand, there's religion that's made of deconstruction, where it's about breaking down the lie of the world. And this is, I'd say, also in like India, right?
Yeah.
Shiva is much more popular amongst hippies than Krishna is. Traditional popular Indian religion is Krishna, which is constructivist and Apollonian. You should be getting a job and building houses and raising families and making milk and butter. And that's the celebration of the great god of like accomplishment. On the other hand, much more in a way deeply embedded and more meaningful in modernity is Shiva, the god of breaking down all the lie of all that, because all of that is all lies. Hevel, Hevelim, Hakol, Hevel. And the first Jewish community that came to Rome, the Romans, informed as they were in real world religion and the problem, were very concerned about ecstatic Eastern religion, which is what they identified with the general ancientist religion and the beginning of religion. And they identified, let's say, the L of construction with Yom Rishon and the L of deconstruction with Yom HaShavi'i. That's a very old Roman conception. Also, they notice, I mean, Heraclitus talks about it, but then Plutarch later on tries to say that first judgment that the Romans made about the Jews was correct. Because what happens is, the Jews like write back saying, no, no, you misunderstand. We're not Dionysians. We're into Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. He's not like anybody else. He has no face. He has no midot. Mm-hmm. It means all the midot, whatever, whatever. It's a whole thing. It's very loaded, but it's not Dionysus. It's all a big mistake. Oh, you misunderstood because you heard us saying this Shabbos and you thought we were saying Shaboy, Shaboy, which apparently certain Dionysian Turks would do. They had a particular thing they would say during the ritual.
Explain a bit more about Dionysian.
Okay.
What is that
It's a very deep question. It's hard to say in a couple of words. Because the most famous popular way to describe Dionysus is as the god of intoxication by the Greeks and Romans. Okay. And he's not really very respected in Rome. They don't make mikdashim for the god of intoxication because those mikdashim would be destroyed in a minute. All the stories about him end in destruction. He's not exactly so popular, except they identify him with a few other Elohim. This is one of the chidushim in Roman tikkunim on Greek religion. Because we think of Greek religion and Roman religion as being one thing. They're all just the same. There's a couple tikkunim they make. For example, the concept of bechinot of elim, where a couple elim are all kulam chadahi, is a chiddush the Romans already have, where they attribute it to one of the Greeks, Heraclitus, saying that Saturn, Pluto, and Dionysus are all one. The El Yom HaShvi. They're all Elohim of like the next world, not this world. And if you're saying Saturn, you're already saying a cosmic force that is the beginning of all the other things in the world. Because Saturn is like the father of everything else that happens. The main story about him is that he basically eats all of his children in order to keep them from overcoming his power, but he can't help but keep having to have children because it's just coming out of him. And they eventually overtake him. And then the next door afterwards, the El that takes over like the universe from all... I wrote that book about Chassidut. Now I'm writing a book about Kabbalah about in the context of world religion. So I've been thinking about this a lot.
Yeah, I see.
I've been thinking about this a lot. Like the difference between
standing on this.
Right. The Yevanim put Tzedek in charge of the Elim. They say Tzedek has the chiddush of Tzedek is that instead of having to win and defeat the other Elohim, he gives each one a place to rule over.
Tzedek is Jupiter.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Tzedek is Jupiter, but he's which is the god of cooperation. Jove, right? Jovial is friendliness. Instead of being Saturnine and just trying to overcome everybody else by eating them and including them within his oneness, he says, no, Tzedek makes gvulot. Tzedek says, you know what? You're actually really good at this, so you should be over here. You're good at this, so you should actually rule over here. And he makes each of his siblings a king. And because he makes them a king, they make him a king. This is also the Koreshi model that goes to the beginning of the Persian Empire, where... part of why the chiddush of having an empire, it becomes so big, is because part of why he's called Koresh, he gives each king authority. Says, you're a king, and because that they say, no, well, in that case, you're a king also. Koresh. I'm a king because you're a king. But that's a whole other thing. Let's say part of the problem with Saturn and with Pluto, who is like the king over Gehenna, and Dionysus, is that they're not into construction. They're into breaking things down. Like Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei is more defined by Yitziat Mitzrayim than he is by building the Beis HaMikdash in a very, very deep way. When people think of the Elohei Yisrael, a bigger priority is to be Goel Yisrael than he is to be Boneh. Boneh Yerushalayim is near the end of Shmoneh Esrei because it's important, but it's secondary to Yitziat Mitzrayim in all the Kiddush of Yisrael. Plutarch says, and furthermore, all of our kiddush is on wine. All of it. Like, it's not on honey. Honey, if you're worshiping Apollo and in all the Apollo temples, including the Krishna ones, right? They're all, like, you know, they're having like a sweet thing as the sign of like, yay, honey. Because honey is about perfection in a lot of ways. Whatever. For whatever mystical reason, I don't understand Greek religion so much. But wine is about deconstruction. Is about, and so much of the avoda of Chazal and of Yahadut, of the being kofer on avoda zara, right? Let's say if you're trying to build structures, you're building idols. You're building a Beis HaMikdash, you're already building something, and if the avoda is to build beautiful things in divine image, okay, that's great. But so much more of the trip from Avram Avinu on down is deconstruction, is to say that El is not El, is rejecting avoda zaras. Much more adherent to the definition of Yehudi, going back to at least the Gemara, is to say kofer on avodah zarah. not to say Bone Yerushalayim, as important as that is, but Kofer an Avodah Zarah.
Meaning, Sur Merah Ve'aseh Tov. If you kind of
Sur Merah first.
Stop doing the negative thing, and then you'll kind of be on the right path, maybe.
Right, you think it'd be the opposite. You think like Olam Chesed Yivaneh would be the bigger priority, and that is the bigger priority, maybe by Avraham Avinu, but maybe not. Maybe the nature of the world, the nature of the problem of the world, is there's already so much good built up that became a problem. Because the beginning of the problem is just too much good. This is an old, this is a perush on Tov Ma'od in the Briat HaOlam.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a lot of the Bracha of Yerushalayim since before history is processing and breaking down more than building up. Like, let's say part of the definition of the holiness of Mitzrayim and the holiness of Babylon is these amazing structures, Migdal Bavel, all the Mikdashim in Mitzrayim, everything good that societies are able to accomplish when they have access to resources and ambition and wisdom. And so much of what Yerushalayim has always been is a place of offset and breakdown. Malkit Tzedek offers Avraham Avinu that first Kiddush wine, traditionally. Even though it's always named after Tzedek, like, you know, Malkit Tzedek, Adoni Tzedek. So much of what I associate with Yerushalayim street culture since forever is more processing. You know, you come from different places and you process what you've learned, the good and the bad. Part of Avraham Avinu's doing with Parsis Lech Lecha is getting away from the excesses for the sake of perspective and trying to get down what he can figure out from the rest of it. And substances are very helpful for that because there's a lot of perspective we can have except through triggers to have perspective. Now, part of that is words and conversations and listening, but to even hear words and connect to conversations, substances are amazingly helpful. That's why they're popular. That's why all of socialization is built around alcohol.
But alcohol
or coffee.
Is still, you were talking, let's say, about the temple, if you're talking about Judaism, right, per se, is wine doesn't seem, maybe I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, that it didn't seem prominent in the Bible, in the Tanakh.
Ola satamid venisko.
What?
There's always sacrifices and the nisachot on them.
Yayin
b'seichar. Yayin b'seichar does come up a lot. But you're saying good. It's
I'm
not
saying
as described.
That
as
nowadays, you're mentioning that every single Saturday, every single holiday, everything, it's based on wine. We don't start eating till you hear Kiddush.
Right. Although you have to have mezonah with Kiddush. It's a funny thing to offset that it shouldn't get too out of control. That's a Rambam rule, right? You're not supposed to get drunk, but if you have food, it's fine because you're not going to get drunk.
Well, the wine then, they say, was much weaker, right?
They say it was much stronger.
Huh?
They say it was much stronger.
No, you think?
Don't they say it was stronger?
I don't know.
They say it was instead of water. And one of my favorite rules in the Gemara is that if a Rav makes a psak on Shabbos or Yontif, you don't hold by it, he's probably drunk.
Probably drunk.
Yeah, he's probably drunk, so you assume he's drunk and you don't hold by anything he paskins on Shabbos or Yontif until he sobers up.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So what do you, how do you see that then, that kind of the character of the material of wine or alcohol as opposed to cannabis? I mean,
that's a great question, and it's an important question. Because
I mean, just from that perspective, I mean, obviously, a lot of times people who support the legalization or use of marijuana and cannabis, they'll go and they'll say, but what about alcohol? Alcohol kills more people. Alcohol's more dangerous. It's worse for your systems. And
right, that's how they legalized in Colorado. The whole legalization in Colorado was because this guy, Ian Sieb, also a Yid, coincidentally, at some kind of big public thing, like the governor, the governor's family got rich off beer from the Coors, from the Coors dynasty.
Coors,
tap the
beer.
Rockies, Coors Light.
Coors, and American beer
course,
is terrible.
Of course, it is.
Of course.
But there's a lot of it. And at some kind of big event, he just challenges him, how about this? Like, I'll take a hit of weed for every sip of beer, and we'll see who does better. And it was a huge public embarrassment that forced the governor to reconsider everything and would just publicly raise the whole problem of how much more destructive beer and alcohol is than marijuana, but how much more popularly, let's say, central alcohol has been.
And taking that to the more sacrificial space. I mean, if you went to some square person, to some regular person, I'll say, yeah, I'll have a bit of wine every Saturday, of course. When you talk to them about smoking marijuana, they're like, what, that's drugs.
Right.
Excuse me. I'm talking about a sacrificial thing that I do every Saturday.
Right.
I could also do it on grapefruit.
A normal
grape
thing.
Juice if I want.
I'd rather do it on grape juice. Right.
But why do I need that? And also the character, obviously, of alcohol is different than marijuana. And you're trying, if you're supportive of use of marijuana as a connection to some kind of spiritual realm, why is that an alternative to wine? And why hasn't it been an alternative popularly in the past hundreds of years?
So that's a great question. And that question is how that book got written. Was I came to Yerushalayim trying to answer exactly that question. I was wondering myself, because my exposure to marijuana was not in religious Jewish contexts. It was with like street kids in New York City. And before I ever smoked, I was very much as anti-drug as everyone is supposed to be, because I wanted the good rules that would help me be creative and functional and relate from conscience, not just from some kind of avoiding of the world. I believed and took those values for granted as much as anybody else, as much as all kids are supposed to, because I identified as a good kid. Some kids in school, they said, I'm a bad kid, so I do bad things and it's fine. That's who I am. And I was into it from like preschool. I was like, I'm on the good team. I'm into like the good rules. The problem was so much of the rules were stupid, and it became clearer and clearer how much the teachers themselves would not differentiate between the good rules, which make playing safer and make us all more sensitive, and which I identified with the Torah and with Halakha, and the dumb rules, which I associate with like Malchus Hazadon. As a kid, just with like the...
Try to explain.
Sure, sorry.
You're saying like big terms, and I'm like, wow, you're blowing me away.
Right. From being a kid in school, it was easy to tell the difference between good teachers and bad teachers. Good teachers seemed genuinely concerned that you should do well and be happy.
Yeah.
And bad teachers just wanted you to be quiet. That was really it. They just wanted you to cooperate so they could do their thing. Maybe they had something they wanted to say. Maybe they didn't. But they didn't really care about you so much. And their rules were clean, not necessarily about you. They were about just making it be that they could, you know, do what they wanted. And it was very clearly different from the other rules. The rules themselves seemed to be an insult to the very purpose and idea of rules, which is that things should be good so you can play nicely and have fun. And taking a step further, even as a kid, it fit in with a lot of my like familial mythologies to have a sense of like the good authority in the good laws and the sense of the kind of good person you could be by finding the good rules and keeping them, and wicked authority, which is basically about power, imposition, and control for the sake of somebody else's good time, not yours.
But then you decided at some point to break the rules and to do something that was wrong.
Right. And I was egged on by all the music that I liked, all the music and poetry and literature from a bunch of different genres, which you'd hear outside, you'd hear good music, you'd hear about something good. And the common denominator between all of it, white people, black people, Latinos and Asians, was marijuana. That was the thing they all seemed to respect in common. And the more I got into like a health as a teenager and the idea that like there was hidden truths that had been repressed and hidden values that had been repressed, as part of, let's say, the Bracha of Israel also, Tchelet, and what happened to Tchelet, all the things that we had.
Lost knowledge.
Yeah, lost knowledge and lost priorities. This was part of the definition of Judaism I received as a kid in school. In the most Orthodox day schools and in the Hasidic neighborhoods was, we're really sorry, most of the best stuff has been lost. It was very messy, we didn't have time, we were all running very fast. Most of everything good about how this is supposed to be is lost, and everything we're doing is Zecher. Right, in memory of how things are supposed
to be. And worst off is the fact that, okay, we don't have that, let's try to explore it again. Let's try to maybe see what that meant for us.
Right, which is associated with danger, justifiably, because a lot of the things we don't have might have been part of the problem that meant we didn't have them. This is one of the mysteries of all the criminalization, of the destruction of the temple and all the dispersion and all the exile, is how much of the things that we treasured the most about the old world were exactly why we don't have them anymore. You know what I mean? It's a bit of a mystery. What are the things from the Beit HaMikdash?
Because
there's a lot of
romantic.
Because there's two aspects of the Holy Temple in Judaism. There's romanticizing how good and perfect it was, and then there's everything it says in Tanakh about how bad it was, where the whole thing becomes a problem from the beginning, and that's part of why it's broken down. And part of the blessing in its destruction is being liberated from the problems inherent to it, and thus put into exile. And this is one of the hugest mysteries in the whole Torah, hugest mysteries in any kind of relationship to the Torah, is what are the disasters that are like only tragic, and what is the thing in the disaster that actually made it possible for us to be as free as we are? It was a big issue, especially in New York, right? Because Williamsburg, it's not a Tzionish neighborhood. It's like
Satmar, right?
Satmar, pure Satmar.
So tell me, you're living now part-time there, part-time in Israel, right?
Yes.
You kind of go back and forth?
I go back and forth a lot. The oldest, longest-running Orthodox temple in Brooklyn is now under my family's stewarding and responsibility. And so I'm trying to do stuff there. I'm trying to do good stuff with it. And it's a challenge because of the mystery of what's too much and what's not enough, and how to circulate and who to circulate to, and what to do with what you have, how much to circulate and how much to change. Very big problem, very big confusion. The rule is try to keep things as stable as possible, but the other rule is don't lose what you have by trying to hold on to it too tightly. Very delicate. And marijuana comes back to it a lot for me. It's a very big moral confusion. Part of the goal of Cannabis Chassidus, and part of the goal in searching for a tradition of it in Yerushalayim, because you're saying, good, why bother tying it back to Judaism? Why not just have it as a floating thing? Most marijuana culture that I found in New York and in Yerushalayim amongst religious and secular Jews is just its own thing. You know, they don't try to tie it into davening necessarily. They don't try to tie it into an official devotional practice. Just like smoking weed. Most of the old hippies I spoke to.
Do you have a problem with that?
How much of a problem do I have a right to have with it, right? I do have a core problem with it, because I do have a Yetzer Hara to think that everything should be sacramentalized. If it's good, there should
be
a whole bracha about it. And I feel like it's a Yetzer Hara. It's not a pure feeling. It's a sort of conceit, you know? Like, really, I respect everything everyone does and how they need to do it, but it just breaks my heart. Feel like there could be making a bracha.
Well,
and that's like a certain sinister
nowadays,
position.
Today that smoking marijuana has become more widespread in society in general. It's not just considered like this kind of dissident thing to do, right?
Right.
So you'll have a friend of mine's 80-year-old grandmother who's smoking because she thinks it's good for a certain aspect, you know.
Right,
now
she can see better.
And she does not want to feel high. She doesn't want to, I mean, maybe she does, but she's speaking. To her, it's a medical issue.
Right.
Then there's the guys in the park, okay, that they're not necessarily looking for enlightenment. Maybe they are. That's a good question.
Right.
But they want to go, and they're like, okay, yeah, let me drink, let me smoke, let me do whatever I want.
Whatever
okay?
makes life less painful
okay.
and more acceptable.
Let's not make this whole big mystical issue. Let's not try to look depth. This is fun. I like doing
it.
It
works.
It's fun.
I feel better.
And then you're talking about, let's say, a guy in India that's sitting, and it's a sacramental issue, and it's really, it's just that. The idea, even if you go India and you meet the people, they're like, the idea of smoking weed for fun, it just doesn't, it's not, it's like, what does that even mean?
It's like fun. What's this fun?
It's like, what do you mean? It's a sacramental issue.
Right.
So the question is, in your perspective, could it be, like, do you look down, you go and you see these people who are taking it for medical issues? Are you against medical marijuana?
Right, that's such a good question.
Aren't you? Theoretically?
No. Let's say, like, there's a lot of good rate rules like that. Forgive me for going back to, like, the Torah, but I guess that was just what I got into as a kid. So it's a lot of my bias and filter is, like, to go through it. There's definitely a difference between using something medically and using something ecstatically. That's a very understood difference. And the major difference is, are you in terrible pain that you need to overcome? And that's absolutely its own thing. Like, all the non-kosher foods in the world are fine for medicine. You can eat all the pork you want if it's helping with your glaucoma. Mm-hmm. That's not a question in Judaism since like forever. I wonder when it was an issue. I wonder if there's like some kind of early Chazal period mm-hmm. where like, I don't know if it's okay. But they seem to decide pretty early that like monkey brains or like, you know, like horse fingernails, if it's good for your arthritis, then it's not a question. You don't make a bracha on it. It's medicine. Mm-hmm. And that's very right. acknowledged and respected deeply, deeply in the entire Jewish law for as long as there's been like a thing like that. I wonder what the earliest source for it is. I almost don't care. Because for sure, medicinal is its own thing. You're in pain and you need to resolve it. And that's such an important responsibility. Even the Apollonians would agree. I mean, how did they make it legalized medicinal? Was everyone agreed? Like, I guess it's probably better that people be... How did so much marijuana research get to happen in Israel? Is for serial soldiers. Just trauma. Mm. Need to get over trauma. And every other conceit in the world is so secondary. Because we're giving those people opium. You know, we're bringing those Demerol and every opiates. Kind of drug in the world. So why not experiment and see if this is helpful? That's a certain level. Alhamdulillah. I can't say I have a problem with it. And it would be stupid to, as much as it's stupid, to try to tell anybody anything. Even more so. There's the other thing. In a lot of ways, my heartbreak about lack of sacramentalization has to do with the things people do that could be a little more meaningful, but then become anti-meaningful, which is an issue with party culture, an issue with drug consumption in general, where and you see how built into alcohol culture is sacramentalizing the alcohol. What I mean is, most cultures, most drinking cultures, mm-hmm. make toasts. I can't think of a drinking culture.
How many languages can you say toast in?
I wish I knew more of them. I'm so unwell traveled. If I spend more time in bars, I could probably do a lot more, right? Only 3 or 4.
All right, what do you got? You have L'chaim.
Salud.
Salud.
If you pronounce salud differently, you've got like 5 languages.
Salud. Yamas. Yamas. You know, yamas.
Right.
Skull.
Skull. Is that...
Skål, it's like Russia? Flemish, like Flemish. Those, I don't know, like those Scandinavian Touché. Countries, oh. I don't know.
Skål. Yeah. They all call their alcohol like water of life. Like vodka and aquavit literally mean the same
water.
Thing. Water of life, specifically. Yeah, life yeah. water. And built into the whole model to keep it from getting into just nihilism and just being about like, rah, to appreciate and turn the whole experience towards something constructive and festive instead of just dark and just creepy. Because that is, I mean, one of the ways people talk about alcoholism is like, oh, you're drinking by yourself. I feel like real alcoholism is when you stop blessing on it. When you can't say cheers. You can't, like the Irish, they have a whole thing, cheers, and take a moment to say, may your every step be a step closer to the... And that is a functional thing. That's a practical thing. Even like, say, like how they justify the idea of l'chaim in the Gemara. They have a whole thing. Why do we say l'chaim? Mm. They say, because there's a rule. If you inside the wine or whatever you're drinking, there might be a snake, a poisonous snake ready to bite you. Which is I don't think they mean that literally.
Symbolic, probably. No.
Let's say, but it sure feels Let's that way. Let's just say, or like there's a thing in the thing you're going to drink that threatens to poison you. And the rule is you're supposed to look at it. Take a moment and look at it and look and check to see if there's anything wrong with it. And if there isn't, you say l'chaim, good news. It's actually okay, it's actually good. And I think that's a good practice in general with any kind of drug consumption and food, because mm-hmm. most of our food consumption isn't really about nutrition as much as about just feeling good. Let's say, like before you eat dessert, take a second and look at dessert and think like, is this really gonna be good? And smell it. See if it smells right, and if it does, then yay, l'chaim. And if not, maybe just save it for the morning.
Do you feel that we should be doing that in general then, about more things?
Sugar
not
is drugs.
Just, not just materials that change our perspective?
Well, although that is what materials do, the chamra tava.
Kind of like you're basically saying to give that bracha, to give that blessing to everything, to
Right, if you're desperate... Then who are you trying to impress, right? If you're like dying and you just need to feel better, okay, fine. And that's a terrible place to be. That's not a great place to live. Really, you should be living from like taking your time, appreciating the things, building frameworks around the things you enjoy so you can taste them, so you can enjoy them. Yes, I'm 100% advocating building everything around being able to appreciate the things we live from so that they are medicine, ironically, in their just peace and in their joy, rather than just stop gaps, because that's part of being able to just be healthier with them, and that's part of building a healthier culture in general. That's part of why alcohol culture is like that. And marijuana culture lends itself to that. I mean, you gave the example of India. That's one of the longer, more continuous examples we have of a marijuana culture practice. And there's a lot to learn from it as far as sacramentalization and appropriate use. Although also a lot to learn from it as far as noticing where use goes. The kind of, because in India, most people don't smoke grass, but sadhus do. Right, except if you've renounced property in this world, and then you've crossed over to this other whole sect of humanity where now you no longer are trying to win or get married or have kids. You're just on the road with your chillum and your like cooking bowl for maybe for begging, maybe for cooking. Some shitote, you're still allowed to get married, but it's not the main priority at that point.
So do you feel then, according to that rationale, does that mean that kind of smoking a lot of weed kind of disconnects you with people? Kind of,
for sure. That's the reason it's mostly avoided, I think, in world culture. And there's a lot of talk in the West about criminalization as if it's a very modern error. And I don't think that's historically accurate. Part of the research I did was looking at the problem and the mystery. I would, like, let's say I grew up, and when I was exposed to marijuana, it changed my life. Amidst all the music and amidst all the poetry and amidst all the Kabbalah and Hasidut I started to get into also, that really felt like they opened doors and explained why a bunch of stuff is being taken seriously and what things are really about. I started to wonder, why is this not part of the whole religion that I grew up receiving the way wine is? Because you're asking a very fundamental question. How did alcohol become the thing and not marijuana? And the answer is exactly what you're saying. The nature of cannabis is deconstructive in a way that alcohol is not, and sort of almost antisocial in a way that alcohol is not. And that made it a lot rougher for building cultures. It became much more of a cabal kind of thing. Like the place where you do have stories of pipe-smoking mystics traditionally in Judaism is not the big crowd. It's the intimate room of weirdo mystics who are already kind of disassociating from this world and having like a conversation to the degree that they're talking at all, besides just sitting in a room humming or something, about very subtle experiences, a little bit disconnected, but on the other hand, connected. And that's always a problem for cultures that depend on participation, which is cultures in general. Like one of the things we've noticed in the West, in America, is the issues with too much marijuana out of context, which is people just being less inspiring. A lot of Hollywood movies about that, about just stoners who are less attractive and likable because they're not paying attention anymore. And as much as part of marijuana culture has been about not being that and proving that you could actually be very functional and involved and invested and still appreciate marijuana, so much of the problem with casual and, let's say, desacramentalized use is slipping into the void of just nothing matters and I don't care, which is part of what people use it for. Let's be honest, part of the problem of the world, especially once religion is discredited and most of the other national values of like, you should are all discredited, is just giving up and going into the void of like, I don't care. Elohim Yishmor. Which I don't think is the highest path. Nice to get some air and clarity from all the lies and all the structures sometimes, but it's also kind of crucial to have a way to tag back in. This is part of what Timothy Leary was suggesting early on with his model, which did aspire to transcend all the lies and all the religions.
For those who don't know, Timothy Leary was involved a lot with giving acid LSD to people in the 60s and acid tests. And he was very popular also as a symbol amongst hippies and musicians, 60s, 70s and onward, right?
Right. As a doctor, as a sort of figure of authority. That was a lot of the chiddush of Timothy Leary, because he really got into it from a place of ke'ilu science. from a place of like social response. He starts as a psychologist, and his really his first great accomplishment was he came up with a personality test for prisoners to gauge people's natures called the Leary test. It's actually one of the funny stories. When he was eventually arrested for talking all crazy and rallying and distributing and whatever else he was arrested for, they gave him the test he designed at the prison, and he filled it out to make it that they would put the least amount of effort into watching him, and then he escaped.
Amazing.
Climbed out the window. But the thing that was radical and controversial and problematic but also meaningful in his shita, because he was not the first person to advocate using psychedelics, he was the first person to advocate freeing psychedelics and making them just something that everyone should just try without much framework. He did suggest framework and said you should use like frameworks and maybe the Tibetan Book of the Dead and maybe different kind of ways of coming up with your own framework for your own psychological development. And one of the main shitot he tries to give over is actually very Neoplatonic in its way. Drop out, turn on, tune in. Now, the outside of that is give up, get out, get high. But the end of it, the resolution of it, was always bring what you've learned from the high place back into the world. And I've heard argued that's also very much the difference between Rabbi Akiva and his contemporaries. Let's say like there's in a whole story of the four that go to paradise, the paradise. Only one really comes back in a way. You know, I mean, three of them come back. One of them dies. One of them goes crazy, whatever that means. I mean, and it definitely is defined in the Gemara as just he becomes invested in discourse that's not related to what other people are relating to, which is the main problem in being crazy. Although the Gemara then tries to address the crazy guy's questions, whatever. One of them gives up on the whole trip. He becomes a kofer, Elisha ben Abuya, and his kfira is defined by his hostility to the rest of the cultural assumptions. He goes into a Beit Midrash and clears it out by talking to everybody just about, you know, you should really be doing something much more useful with your life. He goes to each one and says, like, what are you doing here? You're actually a great carpenter. You're a great shoemaker. And soon the whole place is empty. They make a rule. He can't come there anymore.
But they still say that Rabbi Akiva was one of the four. He used to go after him, right?
Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Meir, who's a student of Rabbi Akiva.
Yeah, he used to walk after him, right, while he was riding on the horse.
Right, and because he felt he could digest what he was saying for all kinds of reasons. But let's go back to Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, why does he go in peace and come back in peace? So one writer I like, Howard Schwartz, suggests that it's because he has in mind he's doing this for the community. All the other guys had existential priorities of their own. One of them was troubled by, like, why is the world the way it is? One of them was, like, just resented this world. One of them was just about the mystery between above and below. Rabbi Akiva, it's really more of a people's person. He doesn't really, as much as he's the one who's making, like, expositions about the crowns on top of letters, he's doing it because he likes his people and he's connected to people. He's, his initial hostility to the whole rabbinic movement is because he feels like they're alienated from people. And part of his main Torah, his most famous thing he says, right? What's the klal gadol in the whole Torah? Is other people. Love your neighbor as yourself. Like, that's the main thing. And because of that, everything he discovers when he gets high, he's able to integrate back into the world. You could say maybe some of his conclusions were problematic.
Yeah.
As, you know, expressed by how much he did not win that war. But, hey, can't win them all.
And I guess so.
Right. The fundamental model that maybe that's the thing that keeps drug use from being decadent nihilistic is how much you're committed to integrating your clarities back into a community and in a continuity. And I think that's really important for people.
You just said before, I want to go back to something you were saying before. You're talking about the inspiration for the book. You came here when you were after high school, right?
Yeah, a little bit during high school. That's where I met your older brother, actually.
Yeah, on
the Or Torah stone. Came here after high school mostly because Yerushalayim was the place.
I'm trying to look back and think about, it's not that long ago, but it's changed a lot, the culture of cannabis in Israel in general.
Yeah.
and growing up. I mean, what was it like for you studying here for a year in a program and such? I mean, was cannabis, I mean, expressing these ideas and searching for that, what was it like? Do you have an interesting story of like what the city was like then in that context?
For sure. It was an interesting time in the city's history because it was right before Birthright became a thing. Up until Birthright became a thing, you really had to care to come out here. The culture in Yerushalayim was pilgrims, was people who actually were very curious and made their way over out of, for whatever reason, to whatever effort. And there was all these post-high school programs, but you had to go to them on purpose. You had to have like a devotional interest instead of just to kind of taking a free opportunity just to come and explore. Marijuana was pretty international taboo at the time. It was really unacceptable anywhere. I was expelled from the program I came on after a month because they found it in my urine. They did a urine test.
Young Judea, your random?
It wasn't so random. There's a whole story around it. I don't know if we have time for it, involving like someone else's activities and how I got mixed up in their story. Wasn't so random. And part of the reason it wasn't random was because I wasn't so careful. Sloppy AF, as the kids say, because I had a certain sort of trip about it as a devotional thing and a certain absurd faith in God deciding what to do about me being relatively honest. There was a rule about it, but I believed in breaking that rule very strongly as part of my life until that point. And I got kicked off after a month and the family lost a lot of money. And from then on, I vowed never to sign up for a program that I'd have to lie to be a part of. Mm. That seemed like just a bad investment. And that's how I first got to spend time with Yerushalayim street culture more, because I was kicked off the program I was on and I still had so many questions. And I found talking to people in the street, drinking in front of ice cream shops, and just around, how informed people were, how much people had come over the last forever with questions and ideas that they'd been building their own lives and culture around, and how much more accessible that was if I would just talk to people in the street than signing up for schools, which had to have their own limitations according to the norms, because otherwise they wouldn't be allowed to function.
That sounds like an adventure. What kind of people do you meet in the street?
Mostly drunks, but mostly old, frustrated ecstatics at the time. Because who's hanging out in the street? Who has time and interest to hang out in the street with a bunch of their friends? People who have done well in their lives to whatever degree, that's not where they are. Yeah. People who have built their lives not around doing well, but around their big existential questions and priorities and hopes and dreams and sensitivities, they were very accessible, almost tragically so. And that is definitely part of the tension, especially at the time. I think there used to be much more of a sacrifice made in a personal life by being involved in marijuana, because you were risking your entire livelihood and all the structure and stability in your life for the sake of this thing. That's shifted a lot. It used to be you had to really keep it on the down low, and it's still probably a good idea. It's one of the big mysteries now. How safe are we really in being any kind of public? How long before the next wave of whoever uses these things to get us in trouble comes along?
What is your perspective about, I mean, you may have heard there's people in certain apps that they use and certain ways that they get marijuana today here in Israel.
Right.
And it's completely different. It's completely different than, I mean, you used to, how would you even, when you were here younger, I mean, how did you even get...
You had to walk around and try to look for someone who looked like they might know something. I mean, the first time I bought weed in Yerushalayim was in Kikar Tzion. I was just walking around. I just looked for the sketchiest Arab I could find. It was like this kid who was like sitting on this fat Arab guy's lap. And I just asked him, hey, do you know where I could find some weed? And they had matchboxes with pretty solid, actually great weed.
That's totally how I met your older brother, was I had weed and no one else did. It was so hard to find any. If you had any, it was like a miracle, but you were in constant terrible danger of like being in jail for years and years. And like one of my main teacher friends, this guy David Hertzberg, Zichron Levracha, in the Old City, he had been in jail for a good 4 years for not that much weed, and it totally changed his entire, in the early 80s, in this whole, there was a center for, early center for like just popular folk Jewish spirituality that had been organized not too far from Kikar Tzion, and there was a lot of fusion between like where you had a devotional, musical, sort of spiritual, marijuana-fueled culture that blurred the line between Chiloni and Dati'i in a way that you really didn't have in the 80s. You really didn't have until you had like music bands and sort of song circle contexts where spirituality was a little bit liberated from the assumptions of like orthodoxy. Didn't really emerge. Those were very separate cultures until pretty recently.
Do you feel that connects to kind of like the Diaspora Yeshiva band, who was a band in the Old City, Rabbi Karlebach, obviously in the 70s?
All of which are in the backdrop of marijuana subculture. Like it's one of the things Diaspora was certainly wrestling with. One of the things Shlomo Chaver was certainly wrestling with. And part of, let's say, Shlomo is never really into grass himself, but he's very into the kids who are.
I've heard that, I mean, I've met many people that were also, you know, people that would hang out with Karlebach, and none of them said that he was directly involved or that he was really into it. But he was, but he must have been immersed into the culture. He was there the whole time, I mean.
Right. The strongest thing people say is that he would hit a joint so that you would trust him, but he wouldn't even really. He would just kind of hold it. He just kind of hold
smoked,
it and start talking.
I smoked, but I didn't inhale.
Right, exactly. Just kind of blow into it. I'm cool too. We're cool. We're cool. Okay, let me tell you something deep, you know? And I think he was very challenged by drug culture. I think it was definitely almost an enemy for him in that he was trying to bring people to caring, really deep caring about each other and God and the Torah, but all of it was very much about noticing each other, love in the purest form. And as much as he appreciated anything that helped people come closer to that, I think he was very frustrated and even confused by how much it was what people related their comfort in and close to. Because he also wouldn't really drink wine, right? He would make kiddush on grape juice. He'd rather make kiddush on grape juice. Even on Purim.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's not really into, because he's pretty high just from the guitar stuff, you know? Some psychedelic theorists argue, like Terence McKenna argues, that a lot of the thing that gets people high in religion without drugs grew out of archaic drug culture from before there was religion. Religion itself and all the sort of contemplative and ecstatic practices, including songs, including the drum, including the artwork, came out of already being that high and then became a way to get that high without needing the substance, which is pretty important once the substance is taken away, once you're just on the road or locked in a dungeon or trapped in the forest.
So drugs are the gateway drug to spirituality?
Or were. And Terence McKenna argues are the real makor and the thing that you should have instead of spirituality, because spirituality is made of priestcraft and dishonesty, and drugs are real.
Drugs are real.
They're real, and the rest of it is something you do in order to get back to the state. A certain kind of radical secular opinion, for sure. Timothy Leary also. I mean, a lot of the people who are into psychedelics are not into religion. They're into liberation from religion. And that's something I've found myself wrestling with a lot, because I really appreciate religion as a framework for making the drugs work better, to be honest. Like, I don't like getting high without a sense of meaning. And as much as I struggle that the sense of meaning shouldn't be a self-perpetuating mythology of lies at the expense of showing up, I really do appreciate the context that it comes back to, and so do my friends and teachers in a lot of ways. The people I like chilling with the most and talking the most with, there's a cycle going back and forth between the experiences of being high and the clarities that come through that feel like breakthroughs. Like Shlomo Karlebach is having these breakthroughs from a different contemplative space that is very similar and a little hard to differentiate from just the piece of like going deeply into a zone and suddenly putting together some thoughts that really do seem to explain a lot of what's going on in my life and in old conflicts and in new conflicts. Because I feel like that's why bother with chassidut once you have cannabis, is because you really do, I really do benefit long-term frameworks. When I was a kid, I was into punk rock, and I was into zines before the internet.
What's a zine?
Exactly. Before the internet, the only way you could really circulate alternative culture was by writing it in a little magazine, stapling it together, and bringing it to a record store in the hopes that someone would see it. And there was one that was Dafka Jewish called the Mazel Tov Cocktail. It was adorable, and what someone passed on to me. For a little while, it was actually a precursor to a magazine called, what was it called? Heeb. Where the lady publishing it decided just to compile all the Jewish punk stuff she could, just as a kind of whim, and then put it in record stores. Interviewed in it was a rabbi named Meir Schiller. He had gotten into chassidut from punk because he loved the ecstasy of punk rock, but noticed there was no kids there and there was no grown-ups there. And he wanted something that was that high, but would support that your entire life. And so he got into like Rav Nachman. And
he is later involved, you're saying, with Heeb magazine.
No, he was really involved with Yeshiva University, but someone found him to interview him to talk about nationalist punk, which is really how he got into it. Not like anarchist punk, but Dafka likes like the nationalist punk stuff, the skinhead stuff.
Interesting.
Which is especially loaded and resonant, meaningful nowadays.
All right. So, well, we got the skinhead. So that's
right.
Always good. What's your future plans? You're discussing that you have your book that you're working on or idea.
Right.
What is that?
More than idea. Well, let's say the end of Cannabis Chassidus, the end of the book is I shouldn't and I don't need marijuana once I am whole and at peace. Like part of the problem of medicine is you shouldn't really need medicine once you're healthy. And a certain amount of tension in my life is I don't want to depend on things at the expense of what I'm using the things for, which is being able to be alive and show up with love. So when I wrote Cannabis Chassidus, it was a little bit to set myself free, that I should have options to stop and create a new identity and not just depend on the things I have appreciated to define me forever, like every other kind of cheesy old guy, you know? So I started on a project called Pop Cartoon Kabbalah, where I tried to then look at my other juvenile passions, cartoons and comic books, and address the themes that seem to recur in it as a sort of way of giving people, specifically kids, a relationship to the things they already love, which is on the one hand, the physical sort of material. Like you said, the materials themselves are awesome, but also their own kind of pickle and confusion, because you could depend on a thing which is never going to be dependable because your relationship to it physically changes, and what it does changes the more you depend on it, as opposed to media and narratives. So the thing I've been working for the last while is trying to come up with a theory of how media and narratives relate to us using the Kabbalistic tradition, ideally the most elemental form of it, the Sefer Yetzirah. So I apply that to just cartoon characters who recur from medium to medium. I use the word cartoon to mean specifically the things, the characters that transcend from one medium to another as it's invented. Once they started inventing like television and movies and internet. So that's what I've been working on.
Pop cartoon, interesting. Kabbalah. We can discuss that, just that, for hours.
.tumblr.com, that's where it's at. It's ongoing.
What did you say? How do you say?
Popcartoonkabbalah.tumblr.com. I've been working on it. The way I did Cannabis Chassidus was as a blog, because it's very hard to write just in general, because what I have to write down for, if I'm just writing to myself, I don't have to write it down, I'm just thinking in my head. But if I have in mind what the platform is, it's easier to circulate. I think that's part of the blessing of materials, of a thing to get high from, is like, let's say you just get high off nothing. How are you going to share that? But let's say you have something that you're getting high from, that's something you can share. So really, platforms and context are the things that keep bringing me back to drug culture.
That's great.
Baruch Hashem.
Okay, wow, thank you. That was... I feel so enlightened.
Whoa.
Okay,
See, that's all it takes.
Before we end the podcast, We have a questionnaire.
Oh. Fill out the form.
Chanel, the producer, hates when I touch paper, so I'm doing it on purpose. Okay.
You dirty paper toucher.
So there's a whole bunch of questions here. You get points, and there's only one right answer. So, you know, you better be a good boy.
Dun, dun, dun. I'm trying.
Okay. In Jerusalem, there are two squares, Kikar Tzion and Kikar Chaturot, which is down the street near Nechalat Shiva.
Right.
Which one do you choose? What's the better place?
For sure, that's a great question. Both of them are not the way they used to be. Both of them are pretty far. So I'd say the Shuk. Shuk Machne Yehuda.
Well, that wasn't one of the two
answers.
I
know, however.
So definitely the right answer.
Where can you sit? Where can you sit in either of them? Kikar Chatulim, there's, I guess you could sit there.
They're both kind of sketchy.
They're both kind of sketchy.
They just finished fixing up Zion Square, I think, like a week ago. I haven't seen
it
yet.
Right, they keep fixing it up. Well, the problem is they're not sketchy enough. That's the problem. They're too attended to really be that fun. There's like four police cars on each one, and they keep rebuilding it with like a bank and another thing on top. And that's nice, I guess, for the kids.
It's always alive. They build it and they destroy it.
Yeah, the answer is the Shuk.
Okay. Wrong answer, but okay. That's the right answer.
Don't tell anyone.
I don't have it written here. Sorry.
Right.
Best falafel, shawarma, sabich that you like, just like a stand in Jerusalem that you like going to.
In Jerusalem?
Something
so,
small.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Legit. I like hummus shel trina on Nisan Bechar as far as a place to sit and do work, and also falafel. My favorite shawarma place in Jerusalem closed down many years ago. My favorite shawarma place nowadays in Jerusalem, I'd say, is Hashamen.
Hashamen.
Yeah.
A specific one? They have a couple, no?
The one in Katamonim is the one I got used to.
Ah.
But Bandura, I live in a deret now, and the ones in Beit Shemesh are the ones. Bandura is actually amazing veal shawarma. It reminded me of like Latin American sort of like grill, and that's a good sign.
Latin American grill.
Yeah, that's how good that shawarma was. I grew up with it as like a staple. Yeah, like they'd make meat and it would taste delicious in a way that other people didn't seem to know how to do it. And Bandura over across from the Big in Beit Shemesh does
the
it really
spice.
Well. I guess, or the angle, or the way they... Angle. I don't know. I don't know what it is. If I knew what it was, I would make it.
Okay. This is the most important question here. What's the one thing... okay. This is an interesting question because I've asked till now only people that have lived here, mostly in Jerusalem, and you kind of go back and forth.
Although I have lived here more than anywhere else.
All right, but what do you think would be the one singular event or events that would kind of detach you from this place, that you would say, I don't want to live here, I wouldn't want to be here now?
That's a big question, gosh. That's such a great question. It would have to be pretty bad. I guess the cops would have to get their shit together. That's really all it would take. Because they tolerate a lot that they didn't used to. You didn't used to have a culture where people smoked weed in front of cafes, or you didn't used to have like a thing in the Shuk where dance parties were a thing, and now you do. And it seemed like that was a political decision. It seemed like there's every so often a political decision. Like when hash vanished from Jerusalem and suddenly weed was the thing instead, apparently that was a Yitzhak Rabin decision, that there would just be weed from the south instead of hash from the north. And when they decided, I guess, to allow personal use, when Nir Barakat decided that he would go and hang out at raves and not arrest anyone when he'd come there, that was a policy thing that they seem to go back on every 2 years. Like the rule in Jerusalem is every 2.5 years the cops crack down.
I must say about that, it's hard to tell.
Well, the rule seems to be they crack down every 2.5 years, and so be careful a little bit. But if they would just stop waiting for the 2.5 years, that would be awful. If they would just make it that just you couldn't do anything cool.
So basically you were saying that the police cracking down, that would be something that would make you...
Yeah, if you couldn't dance or talk.
Harsh.
If they would just watch you as you went down the street, and just dancing and having conversations with strangers was unavailable. There's a story like that from Rav Nachman, the great fixer, where there's a guy, he just like loves to get high once a week at the end of doing all the work. And the king hates him because of it, because he needs to rule the whole kingdom only with sadness. And if anyone's actually happy, it means he's not really such a strong king.
And so he makes everything illegal, basically, that the guy does for money. He's a great fixer. He fixes things. So the next day, fixing is illegal. So he has to do something else. So he offers to clean somebody's front porch. And so the next day, front porch cleaning is illegal because he keeps talking to the king because he doesn't realize the king is not his friend until everything is legal except for joining the king's army. And so what can he do? He joins the king's army. And long story short, eventually he has the last laugh. But that would be awful if you just couldn't do any of the things that I love about Yerushalayim, which is mostly talk to strangers,
talking,
dance, and sing songs.
Dancing.
Yeah, that's what they built the city for.
That seems that's reasonable.
That's what I heard. That's what David HaMelech came here for.
All right. So Jerusalem has lots of little secret spots, right? What spot do you find yourself returning to?
Lately, Power Coffee Works over in the Shuk. Some South Africans made a lovely cafe that you can hang out in front of. It's really great. It's right next to Natural Bakery. So as a side effect, they made it that you can order stuff from the cafe and the Natural Bakery and then sit down and have Wi-Fi, which is an amazing thing. That's really the main place the last while. Besides for that, Nagila is very special just because of...
Nagila, where's that?
It's on Rehov Mashiach Borochov, which is also just a wonderful street in between, like right off the Vitka. Right after Bitka Square, in between Yafo and Agrippas, there's a little magical street, has Holzer's bookstore, which is the best used bookstore, has Nagila, which is a great vegan restaurant, which also is great for just plugging in your computer and getting work done, run by great people, playing good music. That's when I need to like impress somebody and eat food. Otherwise, Power Coffee works if I'm just coming to sit and just like drink coffee and talk to strangers. Y Cafe historically, although it's a little too crowded the last while.
Where?
Y Cafe on Nissan Bechar. Nissan Bechar is also a great street.
Nissan Bechar.
Slow Moshe is closing down.
And that's unbelievably
tragic. That whole street is just like being picked off for whatever region. when we lost the Pargod, that was a big deal.
The Pargod?
When we lost the Pargod,
was awesome.
that was quite awesome.
Definitely.
Baruch Dayan Emet.
Awesome.
I'm sure life is happening somewhere though.
Okay. This is one that's connected directly to Jerusalem. If you had a genie, a magical genie, with one wish that's for everybody besides you, what would it be?
Oh, that's such a good one. That's such a good one. All my first thoughts are incredibly perverse and don't work if it's everyone.
It's everyone besides
it's
you.
Everyone. That they should all have an extra room in their house that I can crash in when I'm in town.
That's the right answer.
Yeah.
That's the right answer.
Yeah. Other people can crash there when I'm not in town, I guess.
Till now, you're about at a million points.
All right. And grinding.
Okay. Last question. This is also a recommendation. Can you give me a recommendation of an ongoing event, bar, festival that's also in Jerusalem?
That's a great question, because what actually is able to successfully recur in Jerusalem? Things seem to go for a while and then don't seem to go on forever. It's such a good, heartbreaking question, because everything I'm thinking of doesn't exist anymore.
That's kind of sad.
That is
pretty
sad.
You're a nostalgic person.
That's the problem with staying in a transitional space for too long. You just walk around the ghosts and remember where things used to be. But Baruch Hashem, new things keep happening. So we'll see what keeps happening. I want to say the Shuk on Thursday night. I really want to say that there's also a Zohar Shir on Thursday night that I don't go to, but I'm so glad it's going on. It's in Katmon, just old hippies smoking weed.
Where is
Zohar.
This?
Can't tell you. Afterwards,
we'll
starts at like 11 p.m. and they just smoke weed and learn Zohar. Just a bunch of these old hippie guys.
Very interesting.
Yeah, academic hippies.
Not that I'd be into that.
No, heavens, no.
No.
It's a little much for me even, because it starts late and there's no... I'm at the point in my life where I really would prefer there be beautiful women hanging around also. I'm going to do something late at night. But yeah, that's a good one. Thursday night Zohar Shir.
That's interesting. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. No doubt.
That's you kept me there with some thoughts. Well, thank you for coming here on the rooftop. I hope you weren't too cold. We were wondering, maybe you'll need a sweater or a jacket.
I brought a sweater and jacket. Okay. I took it off. It's actually pretty hot here.
Yeah, it gets hot. It gets hot here in the booth for some strange reason. Anyway, tell me, how could people contact you? Your book or social media?
Yeah, those are all, it's so easy nowadays. Yosef Needleman, the E is before the L on Facebook. Pop Comic Kabbalah on Twitter is the Twitter handle, and Pop Cartoon Kabbalah with one B and one L. .tumblr.com is where I'm mostly writing from. Facebook is nifty. My email address is what I used to tell people all the time, because that was inside the book, inside Cannabis Chassidus. So it was zakifkafifim@gmail.com. Spelled the way it sounds, zakifkafifim@gmail.com. Those are all very reliable ways. But just Yosef Needleman, YosefNeedelman on Facebook. That's pretty reliable.
And the book?
Cannabis Chassidus, the Ancient and Emerging Torah of Drugs, a memoir, is now in its second printing. It might be sold out, and we're trying to do a third printing in April. And we need to translate it to Hebrew. I never got around to that.
You never translated?
I was going to translate it into Hebrew, but then I got high. I was going to translate it into Hebrew, and then I got high. And now I'm only doing English language podcasts, and I know why. Yeah.
Why?
Because I got high. Because I got high. Because I got high. Do, 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 do.
Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Do, do, do.